Approach the top of the hour, Mr. Michael G. Haskins. What an afternoon it's been on this opening day.
Oh, my goodness, Hugh. I am so filled with confidence. Filled with confidence because the listeners are always coming through for this radio station, are always coming through for this program. Look at here. Hold on one second. Who do we have? We have Thomas Gordon called in with a pledge of support.
Thank you,
for
Thomas
Talk
Gordon.
Back with
Thank
Hugh
you.
Hamilton this afternoon. Joy DeKilly called in.
Thank you.
Larry Hughes, Derek Thompson, Thomas Bird, Norma Belvette, Gulam Chowdhury called in. Loretta Rose called in. There are others who have called in who are calling in right now to WBAI.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you again.
Supporting this radio station, letting everyone know that you have the back of TalkBack, that you have the back of WBAI. You're going to help us get through our issues and come out on the other side stronger. The number for you to call right now, the number for you to call with your pledge of support to WBAI supporting TalkBack is 516-620-3602. It's 516-620-3602. It's a tax deductible contribution to this radio station and supporting this program. You are wonderful. Thank you very much for continuing to believe in this radio station. Thank you so very much. Please continue to call.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, and thank you again. Please keep these coming. Just got a very nice word here from Kathy Davis, who is monitoring the situation there over with the call center. And thank you very much. I think we're on a roll, and we can hit that 100 mark. Just keep these calls coming, okay? Just keep them coming. And thank you so much for being so generous, for being so supportive. You know, we have arguably the best job in the world. You know, we get to bring information here. We get to, as I often say, anybody can tell you what the news is. You come here to find out what it means and why it matters. That's what we do on TalkBack. And then from time to time, we do these long form presentations during these fundraising drives. And you show your support. You deliver every time, and it is such a heartwarming and wonderful thing. I cannot thank you enough. On behalf of my colleague Michael G. Haskins, our audio engineer and director of incidental music, please keep these calls coming. The number again, 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. Stand by for the WBAI evening news coming up at the top of the hour. I'm Hugh Hamilton. You'll find us on Facebook under my name, and it would be lovely if you could check us out on Facebook. Look for our page under my name, Hugh Hamilton, and if you have not yet done so, we'd love it if you'd like us. And I shall see you again on Monday. I look forward to seeing you then. Thank you, and thank you again. The good Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
Please don't stop calling. There's still time. And even after 6 o'clock, after the evening news comes your way, there's still time to call. There's still time to pledge your support, to make a financial contribution to keep this radio station going, to keep this radio station moving forward. Supporting TalkBack with Hugh Hamilton, that number, 516-620-3602. If you're driving now and cannot, use your phone, and of course you can't do that, but what you can do is when you get home, when you get to your location, wherever that might be, you can log on to the website WBAI.org or give to, that's the number two, give to WBAI.org. Thank you so much. Nelson Mandela, thank you so much. Thank you so much. You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI, and of course, we're streaming 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at WBAI.org. And we're happy, those of you who joined us outside of our primary signal area, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and parts of Pennsylvania as well. All right, it's 6 p.m. That's WBAI.org. Don't forget that, WBAI.org. It's 6 p.m. in New York. Please stay tuned for a report of some of the day's events with the WBAI news team.
Good evening. In the news tonight, residents of NYCHA Housing say the city's squeezing them out of parking lots to hand them over to developers. Seniors and elected officials rally at City Hall to demand the restoration of funds cut from senior services. And federal employees rallied in Manhattan saying sequestration is making it difficult for them to do their jobs. With these and other stories, I'm Andrea Sears in New York, and this is the news for Wednesday, May 8th, 2013. Professionals offering free mental health counseling to young victims of Hurricane Sandy say they're still dealing with children badly shaken by the superstorm. Dr. Robert Mata oversees free child and family counseling at Hofstra University, where he estimates about 10 young storm victims have received help. He says it isn't so much the wind, the waves, or the forced dislocation that has traumatized the children he sees. It's how they take their emotional cues from their parents.
Their stability, their world is shaken when they see the parents shaken, when they see the parents unable to cope. Is that associated with the wind and the rain? Absolutely. But if their parents were really cool about it, I guarantee you the children would be far, far less traumatized.
The Family Service League, another source of free counseling for children after Sandy, says it has treated about 10 children as well. Robin Berger-Gaston says Family Service League has seen a recent increase in requests more than 6 months after Sandy.
Their parents or guardians will contact us and tell us that their child can't sleep, they're maybe having nightmares, that they're preoccupied with it every time it rains.
Berger-Gaston says the situation isn't helped by the fact that many families are experiencing delays in getting the money to rebuild their homes.
We know that in most of these cases, what helps these kids and adults most is being able to return to their normal routine. So if that's disturbed in some way, that could make the recovery more challenging.
Dr. Mata says the arrival of summer weather should also help, which will bring children and families back to beaches that are much less threatening than last October.
So it's really that you're now associating, you know, the water, the sun, the waves, the sand, etc., with something pleasant, whereas before you were associating it with your parents freaking out and your water coming into your living room.
But both experts say they're not seeing a tapering off yet in the number of children needing counseling. The New York City Housing Authority is in the news a lot these days. Many residents were hit hard by the effects of Hurricane Sandy, and now city administrators are trying to make deals to sell off parking lots to luxury housing developers, first by raising prices to squeeze residents out of using them, making it easier to sell them off. Hundreds of residents squeezed onto the steps of City Hall today to say they're not having it. WBAI's Rebecca Miles was there and files this report.
Despite the rain, hundreds of New York City Housing Authority residents crammed under the veranda of City Hall today to register their dissent over the NYCHA administrator's plan with the Bloomberg administration to privatize public housing bit by bit. Charlene Nemens is the resident association president at Wyckoff Gardens in Brooklyn.
NYCHA, stop privatizing our parking lots. Yeah. We clearly see an agenda before us that's going to put us out of our homes if we do not fight. If you see, I like those signs, the HUD regulations are being violated. There's supposed to be discussion before the plan. When they come before us, we get the plan and their decision.
Nimmin said they're calling for a meeting to discuss generating income and that raising parking space fees is not the way to do it.
The families receive HUD subsidies in order for us to even live in housing. And to think that our seniors and disabled and residents at large should be receiving a 400% increase is a nightmare. The moment that we decide that we can't park in those parking lots, we're going to be sitting and watching what's trying to happen with the infill properties. They're now trying to develop luxury apartments on our parking lots and our playgrounds at 8 houses in Manhattan. If you think that they won't do it to us, sadly mistaken. So the beauty that we're here together, we're here about our parking lot. This is land use. This is a land use issue, and it must be addressed. NYCHA cannot make decisions without our valuable input.
400% increase on what? Up until this month, handicapped and seniors paid $60 a year for parking near their homes. NYCHA announced they were raising the fee to $270 a year, and renters who used to pay $75 a year will now be expected to pay $340 a year. Members of the City Council joined today's press conference, announcing they'd introduced a resolution at the stated meeting this afternoon to call for greater transparency and process from NYCHA. Those members included Melissa Mark-Viverito, whose district in East Harlem has the largest number of NYCHA residencies, Margaret Chin, Sarah Gonzalez, Robert Jackson, Steve Levin, Rosie Mendez, and Brooklyn's Letitia James.
We just had a press conference with hundreds of residents of public housing who are concerned about an increase in their parking fees. And they're concerned about those fees primarily because the management of New York City Housing is building luxury housing and parking lots. And they believe that this is nothing more than an excuse to remove the cars and parking lots and then to sell them to developers to build luxury housing. They're doing all of this without any transparency, without any input from residents, and they're doing this at a time when they're sitting on $1 billion of capital funds. In addition to that, as you know, NYCHA residents pay $75 million to NYPD, sanitation, and DEP to provide for the same services that taxpayer dollars pay for. These residents really should be treated with respect. We should put a halt on the infill process and the development of luxury housing, and we should, again, use the $1 billion that they're sitting on for repairs and to renovate NYCHA and to preserve public housing. I'm really proud of the residents who came out here today. They're really demonstrating how much power they have, and they recognize that the power really lies in their hands. It's an honor and a privilege to be with them. Save NYCHA.
Patricia Pendroza lives in the Jacob Riis projects, and she says the plan is disgraceful.
Right now, as it is, the parking lots are full, and you can't park nowhere in the city. You know, it costs so much for you to even get parking. So, and for them to raise the parking 400% for people that are on fixed incomes or moderate incomes that are working and just working day by day, check to check, it's inconceivable that the city would do that without even consulting the residents or anything like that, or at least doing it in increments, you know, just 400%, boom, at one time, you know. And that's a way of getting the parking lots, because then the person can't pay their permit, so then they'll lose their permit. So then that's another way, because then they won't give the permit to someone else. They can't afford to pay it. And, you know, it's just horrendous how they're going about. It's like another way of pushing us out, more gentrification.
Patricia says her mother's been living in her apartment for 50 years. It's a home, and to be pushed out because the Bloomberg administration wants to give everything to the wealthy is ridiculous. Mayoral candidate City Controller John Liu attended the press conference today. He said, let's not sell off public property, because once you do, you never get it back. For WBAI's Evening News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting.
Hundreds of seniors gathered on the steps of City Hall today, along with elected officials, to demand that cuts to vital services be restored. WBAI's Linda Perry was there and files this report.
No cuts!
My name is Sandra Williams, and I'm glad to be here, because we need to stop the budget cuts, because all our centers, senior centers, we need to have the activities there to help us, to make us strong, and we pay so much into our incomes where we work all our life, and we should be appreciated.
My name is Inez Pickett, and I'm from Tompkins Park Senior Center. And we have a very good director, Mrs. Burgos, and she's doing everything to keep us open. So we need help.
And help is why those women, along with hundreds of others, made their way to City Hall in torrential rain, just like these women.
My name is Eunice Solomon. I'm from Tilden Senior Community Center in Bronxville, and I'm trying to work very hard to keep up this center because every year we have to do a lot so that it won't be closed because it's of use to a lot of people in the community.
My name is Linda Beckford, and I'm from Tilden Center. And, you know, every year they said they're going to cut. So we're praying now that, they will give us an increase.
The seniors gathered to put an end to the yearly budget dance. Councilwoman Gail Brewer.
We've got seniors on the steps with big signs like Stanley Isaacs and Project Find and all the different centers. And then you're surrounded by press and elected officials. Thank goodness it's not raining. Bobby Sackman, who's with an organization that's the umbrella group for all of the senior centers, is raving and rallying everybody up.
Bobby Sackman with the Council of Senior Centers and Services says it takes 2 months to organize the yearly Senior Advocacy Day.
And we work with the senior centers around the city. We give them talking points. We make the appointments with the council members. And then the senior centers bring them in a van. And it is a big effort because these people can't jump on a subway and show up. And they come. It was pouring this morning. We had flash flood warnings. My feet are still wet. And they show up. And I just always think it's remarkable. It always touches me very much when I see them come.
Do they show up because of the budget dance every year?
They're tired of the budget dance, but they know that it's an important thing that they have to participate in. And we want to say to whoever the next mayor is, you cannot do policy by budget dance. We need an age equality agenda. And we need the next mayor to have a plan in place and to really work and take older adults seriously.
My name is Jeanette Wills. I'm from Mount Darrett Center, and we would like our senior center to stay open because it helps a lot of people. Some is in bed bong, and we got to take up the food, and we would like for it to stay open. Please talk to the mayor. Mayor, please give us more money.
And as Mayor Bloomberg walks up the steps to City Hall, seniors take notice.
The seniors stood up and they said, not only do we want no cuts, we need more money. The seniors are the fastest growing segment of New York City's population. Do you know that baby boomers turned 70 in 2016? That's not so far away from now. So they said to the mayor, stop the cuts, and we even need more money because these services are lifeline services for people.
Councilwoman Brewer says what the mayor proposed are ancillary cuts to senior services.
Geriatric mental health is cut on the mayor's list. We'll hopefully put that back. Case management, which means the social worker or caseworker to work with individual seniors who are having problems maintaining their rent or hoarding or things like that, that has been cut. There are lots of other programs that may not fit exactly into a niche that the mayor has cut. So we're here to say that these programs are absolutely essential.
In New York City, the fastest growing segment of the population is now 85 years plus. Councilwoman Brewer says frail seniors and younger seniors are two populations which don't have enough support. She says when you have infrastructure and support services, it not only helps seniors, but every single New Yorker.
Well, let me give you an example. When you put curb cuts, which are good for wheelchairs, it helps the strollers. When you fix the traffic lights to make sure that they are timed and have the countdown, I love them. So does every other New Yorker. But they really were built for the seniors so they could cross more effectively and slowly. And third, when you have innovative senior centers that are technology savvy, that have programming, it's good for the whole neighborhood. These senior centers are often, like the libraries, the backbone of our communities, and hopefully they could be used even more regularly than what they are.
Case managers who assist an invisible population, the homebound elderly, have caseloads of 85 clients. 1,000 people are on waiting lists for a social worker to visit their homes and assess their needs. And with the economic downturn and high cost of living, more and more elderly are seeking assistance, while funding continues to be threatened each year. Queens Councilman Jimmy Van Bramer says clearly programs for our children and seniors should not be on the chopping block every single year.
Why even cause the stress for seniors and children to go through this when in fact we're going to restore most of it, we should restore all of it, we should increase these funding, but to subject seniors to this is really unfair.
Van Bramer, along with other council members, say they won't stand for cuts to senior services. Brooklyn Councilwoman Sarah Gonzalez.
Every year we go through this dance. I'm budget negotiator for Brooklyn. I stand strong with my seniors. These are the legacy of our city, and we need to ensure that they get what they need, and I'm going to fight for them.
My name is Margaret Lopez. I'm representing Van Dyke Senior Center. We need the programs going on in our community center, senior centers, and also we don't want budget cuts, and we all vote, so voting is our power.
Seniors vote! Seniors vote!
Besides hundreds of seniors at City Hall gathering to remind legislators that they are a strong voting public, more seniors lobbied the City Council, meeting with 45 of the 51 council members, calling not only for a stop to budget cuts, but for more funding for senior programs and services. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.
On Tuesday, hundreds of members of the National Treasury Employees Union, the nation's largest union of federal workers, gathered at Federal Plaza in Lower Manhattan to demand an end to sequestration. Sequestration was the doomsday scenario of across-the-board budget cuts that were supposed to force Congress and the White House to agree on a budget and deficit reduction measures. But there was no agreement, and on March 1st, those cuts went into effect. Colleen Kelly, national president of NTEU, says the effects of sequestration have been devastating on the ability of federal workers to do their jobs.
The budgets have been cut to the point that they're just not able to do that work, and now they're all looking at unpaid furlough days, 5 to 7 of them in the IRS, up to 14 days at Customs and Border Protection. And those furlough days have not even started yet. So once they start, the public will not even have access to the employees who they depend on to do that critical work every day. On a personal note, the impact has been very harsh on federal employees. They're under a 3-year pay freeze in the 3rd year of a pay freeze. And now they're going to be looking at unpaid furlough days, which will impact their take-home pay between now and September 30th.
Some of the employees who are affected by this are those whose responsibility includes collecting revenue.
That is correct. Whether directly or indirectly, they collect the revenue that funds the entire federal government. The IRS brings in 93% of the revenue that funds every other federal agency. So when the IRS is not properly funded or has their budget cut as they have under the sequester, they are also cutting Homeland Security, and they're cutting Veterans Assistance, and they're cutting school lunches for children, and they're cutting the Food and Drug Administration and the EPA. Because the IRS brings in 93% of the revenue, it has a direct impact on the IRS, and then a very direct impact also on every other agency that's depending on, as you said, to have that revenue collected.
So this will have a direct, even measurable impact of something like $4 billion that this will cost the federal treasury?
Yes. In fact, the sequestration cut for the IRS is $600 million. And on average, IRS employees collect $7 in revenue for every $1 that is invested in the IRS. So with a $600 million cut under sequestration, there will be $4 billion, with a B, that go uncollected that will increase the national debt rather than decreasing it, which is supposedly what Congress is supposed to be trying to do.
Is Congress getting the message that not only are poor people and many other individuals being hurt by this, but the government itself is suffering under the sequestration?
You know, there are many in Congress who understand it and who are looking for a compromise, some kind of an agreement to bring this sequestration to an end. But there are too many others who just want to see government spending cut. They don't really care at what cost. But I believe even they are starting to see the impacts of sequestration in their community. Whether it will be about these furlough days when federal employees won't have the money to spend in the community because they won't be collecting a salary, whether it's about wait lines at international airports or ports of entry into the country, whether it's about complaints that go to the EPA about air and water pollutants that cannot be investigated because employees are being furloughed. We told them it would be gradual, that they would not see it all on March 1st. Many who supported the sequester said there will not be any dramatic change on March 1st. Well, there was not a government shutdown, so there was not a dramatic change. This has been gradual, and as I said, the furlough days, most agencies have not yet started serving them. The EPA has, and the IRS will actually be closed on May 24th, on a Friday, when taxpayers across the country are trying to get help from them, whether it's about identity theft or getting their refund, or small business owners who are looking for help. When they call the IRS on May 24th, there will be no one there, and no one will be allowed to work that day to help the public. And that's when they're going to start really seeing this.
And the recent example of clearing the way for air traffic controllers to not be furloughed seems to be an example of the fact that the government can act when they feel their vacation travel plans may be affected.
Oh, I would say that's a good example, that there obviously are ways to do this. There are ways to address spending, to make some cuts, just not these draconian dramatic cuts that are going to hurt the American public as well as federal employees. But first and foremost, it's about the services that the public depend on from federal employees. And you're right, it wasn't new money. They just found a way to redirect money in the FAA to stop those furloughs. And there are some who support that kind of a piecemeal effort agency by agency. NTU actually thinks that there needs to be an across-the-board correction of this sequestration. Many people are looking at this saying, well, we can get through September 30th, which is the end of the fiscal year for the government. But what they don't understand is this is a one-year piece of legislation. The Budget Control Act that put sequestration in place is a 10-year piece of legislation. And if this is allowed to continue every year, starting on October 1st, they are going to be looking for $100 billion more in cuts from federal agencies. And those cuts cannot be made in the future without seriously impacting the agency's ability to deliver on their mission for the country. So this isn't just about getting through September 30th or some short-term issue. This is a 10-year issue, and that legislation needs to be rescinded, and they need to find a reasonable and balanced way to reduce spending rather than this sequestration.
Colleen Kelly is president of the National Treasury Employees Union. The union that represents custodial workers in the New York City school system released a report today highlighting what the union says is the serious deterioration of almost every single city school building. Local 32BJ of the Service Employees International Union was joined by several members of the city council today in calling for the Department of Education to stop reducing funding for the repair and maintenance of schools or face a future in which some schools may be beyond repair. WBAI's Jose Santiago discussed the report with Hector Figueroa, president of Local 32BJ of the Service Employees International Union.
What we have found is very disturbing. First, that only 2% of New York City schools are in good condition, and hundreds of schools are failing to meet the accessibility, building code, and environmental criteria. For example, 3,400 building code violations were found in more than 620 school buildings, and over 5,000 environmental control board violations were found in slightly over 900 schools. So these were issues that remain unresolved as of February 2013. In addition to that, it is part of the research that we have been doing that New York City is spending a smaller percentage of its total education budget on maintenance and operations than 6 of the 7 largest school districts in the country. Mm-hmm. So we are not only failing our kids in terms of their achievement, our poorest communities and the working class come already with a disadvantage before they even enter kindergarten relative to higher income children. But in addition to all of that, our children are being asked to learn in schools where the toilets are not working, where toxic PCB light fixtures are remaining and leaking and being dangerous to their health, or at least put their health at risk, where schools get flooded frequently, where windows very often do not work and do not meet the standards of saving energy, therefore wasting money for taxpayers. I mean, it's a complete disaster. Mm-hmm. Most of these violations are concentrated in school districts and schools in some of our city's poorest neighborhoods and in largely communities of color. So it's a very disturbing picture that we feel doesn't reflect the values and the interests of New Yorkers in making education be the equalizer. Instead, it's exacerbating the inequality within our own children.
Is the reason for this the fact that there is not enough money to do the repairs, or that the money that is there is not being utilized properly?
We know, we are aware that there have been cuts to the facilities management, you know, allocation for maintenance and custodial work. Mm. We know for a fact because our members' hours have been cut. We have lost members, and every year the custodial personnel is asked to do more with less. So, yes, we think that money has not been accessible in the way that it used to be. But in addition to that, because the problems are unattended, the cost of fixing our schools is growing year after year after year. So by not taking action now, mm-hmm. by not readjusting the budget, finding money, what we're doing is we're just increasing the price tag for future generations, for, you know, the next mayor, for future taxpayers, and the cost of fixing our school will be even worse.
And I know you're looking at it from the standpoint of the conditions of the schools and what's leading to those conditions, but what are you hearing from educators as to how those conditions and children learning in dilapidated classrooms, how it impacts their education?
Yeah, what we've been hearing is that the worsening physical condition of our schools also affects academic performance by our children. That generally speaking, children who are in a better physical environments learn more. It goes hand in hand with the overcrowding, and that the routine of teachers is disrupted when children do not have accessible bathrooms near the classrooms, when the windows in the classrooms that they're learning are broken, and when the heating and air conditioning systems don't work properly, and when there is flooding in the school. Teachers have to juggle and are dealing with situations that are incredibly distracting and stressful for the children. In addition to that, PCBs is proving toxic fixture in our buildings. It's already been proven that it affects health, and it's one of the reasons why PCBs need to be replaced, but they're not being replaced fast enough within our school system. So we have a lot of reason to believe that this is not simply about the health and the security of our children, which I would argue is something that we should care about, but that it also affects the academic performance of the children and the ability of the teachers to focus our students on the learning experience that they need to have.
So what do you recommend, what do you want to see from the administration, from the city council, from the policymakers in the city?
Well, first and foremost, we would like to see city government paying more attention to this issue. We encourage the city council, and we'll approach both the council speaker and council members to hopefully have a hearing process and examination of how the city is spending money on maintenance and how can we address these problems, which we think are urgent. Second, we want to find new sources of revenue and to prioritize school facilities funding. It is not a small issue that not only is the facility deteriorating and less money going into the maintenance of our schools, but our own maintenance workers are also overlooked and very often not treated with the respect and the dignity that they deserve. So one of the issues that we're also raising, and we will continue with follow-up studies, is the working conditions of our maintenance staff, who have not even received a raise in 5 years and, you know, barely have supplies to work with. Our schools should be looked as places where we save energy, we improve the efficiency of how they function. It will save taxpayers' dollars. There may be federal monies that we could channel through our schools And but we have to make sure that the savings that are obtained by increasing the efficiency and the energy saving of our schools remain within the school system. The way that the facilities management budget works now, many of those savings go to central government and then they disappear through the rest of the agencies. And then last, we certainly want to remove the toxic PCBs from our schools at a far faster rate than the administration is proposing. The administration has a 10-year plan, which we think is just too long and puts our children at risk.
Hector Figueroa is the president of Local 32BJ of the Service Employees International Union. He spoke with WBAI's Jose Santiago. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, May 8th, 2013. The news was produced in New York with Jose Santiago, Rebecca Miles, and Linda Perry. I'm Andrea Sears in New York for the WBAI, listener-supported news.
Hi, I'm Rosie Perez, and this is WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York.
This is Al Jazeera.
The first PKK fighters are expected to arrive in Iraq within the week. The withdrawal is part of a peace process meant to end nearly 30 years of conflict. I'm Lauren Taylor, this is Al Jazeera from London. Also coming up, upholding their acquittals, an Egyptian court says 24 former officials won't be retried for the Battle of the Camel during the revolution. Game over for one of world football's giants. Manchester United's Alex Ferguson announces his retirement. And from child soldier to rapper, the Somalis using their music to promote peace. Hello, the withdrawal of Kurdish fighters from southeastern Turkey has begun. It raises hopes of an end to a conflict that's lasted nearly three decades and cost tens of thousands of lives. Omar Al-Saleh reports from northern Iraq.
A senior Kurdish-Iraqi official has confirmed that fighters from the PKK have started withdrawing from their bases in Turkey, heading to the mountainous areas of northern Iraq. Now, this move is hailed as a historic move and is also seen as a significant step towards ending the conflict between the PKK and Turkey.
Azizi Yegit is a Kurdish mother of eight. One of her sons was killed while fighting with the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK. Another son is jailed in Turkey for being a member of the outlawed group. And her third son has been fighting the Turkish army in the mountains for 14 years. Now she wants peace.
I have been looking for the bones of my son for years to bury them and have a cemetery to pray. But I am ready to leave all those aside. All I want is peace.
The PKK said in a statement that despite harsh weather conditions, the pullout is going according to plan. The first group of fighters could take up to a week to reach its bases in the mountains of northern Iraq. There are about 2,000 fighters based in Turkey, and their withdrawal will be gradual.
But what's important is that they are not leaving their weapons behind. The PKK declared a ceasefire after talks between its leader Öcalan and the Turkish government. The pullout is a significant step of the peace process after 29 years of war, in which 40,000 people were killed. But what the Kurds will get in return remains unclear. This analyst suggests that the only reason to push the Kurds to accept peace is by gaining more rights.
This peace process is the most important thing happened in the Turkish modern history since the establishment of the Turkish Republic state in 1923-24. This is the first time the Turkish government, the Turkish officials announced Kurdish as a main issue in Turkey. This constitution will redefine the citizenship in Turkey and at the same time will give the Kurdish people more political and economic and social rights in Turkey.
This could be a turning point in ending the bloody conflict and the hope that the suffering of the Kurdish and Turkish people will come to an end.
But the peace process could take months, and there are challenges ahead. The Turkish government has to implement political reforms as well as constitutional changes to give Kurds some recognition as well as cultural rights. And that is opposed by the main opposition party in Turkey.
Fadi Hakuro is an associate fellow specialising in Turkey at the think tank Chatham House in London. He joins me now. Thanks for coming in. What do you think the impact is going to be of these heavily armed PKK fighters heading into Iraq?
I think that it is a significant step that the PKK fighters are withdrawing to Iraq, but they're withdrawing to Iraq on their own terms. They have refused to lay down their arms, as called for by the Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan. So it is a significant step, but the key question now is what comes next.
And on that question, I mean, in the past, in a 1999 withdrawal, the Turkish military attacked the rebels. They killed around 500. Is that, what chances are that something similar happening again?
I think that the likelihood of such an encounter is remote, because the Turkish political leadership have given their public assurance that they will not repeat the mistakes of 1999, that they will not, that the Turkish military and security forces will not target retreating PKK fighters.
What about the Kurdish minority more generally? I mean, if the PKK do pull out and it all goes smoothly, then what happens to them in Turkey?
Now the key question is what the government is going to do next. Because now that the PKK, from their point of view, have fulfilled their end of the bargain, namely declaring a ceasefire and gradually withdrawing back from Turkey into the mountains of northern Iraq, they expect now the Turkish government to deliver significant political concessions, such as devolving power from the center to the local administrations, changing the definition of citizenship so there's no more ethnic references, etc. And if the government doesn't deliver, then this process could easily unravel.
What about other countries in the region that have Kurdish minorities? They'll be looking at this and, you know, wondering how it affects them. What do you think the regional impact will be?
I think that the Kurdish problem in Turkey is essentially within Turkey's borders, and the solution is within Turkey. No doubt that Turkey needs to engage with its neighboring countries such as Syria and Iran and Baghdad to prevent outside forces from pushing or mobilizing the PKK in the wrong direction. But nevertheless, if Turkey does succeed in promoting peace with its Kurdish population, then I think that can have a significant positive impact in the region, especially in Syria.
Okay, Fadi Hakuro, thank you very much indeed for your analysis. Appreciate it. Well, there's been more fighting between Syrian rebels and government forces for control of a town near the southern border with Jordan. Syrian troops have been battling the opposition in Kirbet Ghazale for the last 2 months. The town is on a key international supply route running from Jordan to the Syrian city of Dera. Rebels lost control to Syrian army troops on Tuesday. About 1,000 rebels have been fighting the government advance on the town. Egypt's High Court has upheld the acquittal of officials loyal to the former president, Hosni Mubarak, in the so-called Battle of the Camel trial in Cairo. Prosecutors had hoped that new evidence would lead to a retrial. Maria Raggi has the details.
Shocked and dismayed, Hamdeya Geber says she cannot understand how the people she accuses of plotting her son's murder were exonerated again.
How is it that all of these officials are being acquitted after the revolution? No one can convince me that these people are innocent. We all saw what happened in Tahrir. The whole world saw.
34-year-old Nasreddin Awais is one of at least 11 people killed in the worst attack on protesters during the uprising. More than 1,000 others were also injured in the so-called Battle of the Camel on February 1st and 2nd, 2011, when Hosni Mubarak's supporters on horse and camelbacks charged into the protesters. Among those tried for the violence were senior members of Mubarak's inner circle, including the speakers of the upper and lower houses. But all 24 defendants were acquitted last year. The court said there was no evidence to link them to the attacks. And the appeals court on Wednesday agreed. Its decision is final, which means the defendants cannot be tried for the same crime again. For Hamdeya Geber's family and many who took part in the protests, the trial is yet another example of a poorly prosecuted case after the revolution.
Of course, Mubarak had the nerve to tease the families of the victims by smiling and waving when he appeared in court last month, because there's no justice. If this absence of justice continues, there will be another revolution.
Wednesday's verdict brings an end to the legal case, but it provides no resolution. Many people here will be left wondering who was behind the Battle of the Camel attack.
Al Jazeera, Cairo.
More now on our top story, the PKK pullout from Turkey. Kurdish immigrants living in Germany are watching closely as the PKK begin their withdrawal into Kurdish-controlled northern Iraq. Germany is home to the biggest Kurdish population in Europe. Some 800,000 live there, and many of them support the PKK. As Nick Spicer reports from Berlin, many German Kurds are now planning their return home.
This Kurdish community center has just reopened again. It shut down several times after repeated inspections because of suspected links to the PKK. But now it's back in business, just as the news comes that the Kurdistan Workers' Party is essentially going out of business in Turkey, disarming and withdrawing from the country.
If peace lasts, I want to return to my homeland. I've lived in Germany for 40 years, but I don't feel tied to this place. If you're a Kurd here, you aren't treated well at all.
Part of the improving situation for Kurds in Turkey is because of outside pressure. The European Union has long dangled the prospect of possible EU membership to get Ankara to give the Kurds in that country more rights. But when it comes to the PKK, Germany and the European Union still label the party a terrorist organization.
The retreating PKK fighters plan to head to northern Iraq, just one of the five countries where Kurds have historically lived without a homeland of their own. This writer says the German government needs to accept that the PKK is changing, but he doesn't expect its ban on the party to be lifted anytime soon.
German politics takes a long time to catch up when it comes to such decisions, so I don't have any illusions. For now, I would just welcome it if the government were to stop prosecuting Kurds here.
There's a feeling among many German Kurds from Turkey, who largely support the PKK, that now is a time of promise. But there's an awareness as well that there have been ceasefires before in nearly three decades of conflict, and the violence returned. Nick Spicer, Al Jazeera, Berlin.
And some breaking news coming into us from Syria. We're getting reports that the leader of the powerful rebel force Al-Nusra Front has been wounded by army bombing near the Syrian capital, Damascus, on Wednesday. This is Abu Mohammed al-Jawlani, who's apparently wounded with other members of his group in the southern Damascus province. And that's according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. We'll bring you more stories on the wounding of that key rebel figure as soon as we get them. Now, in the U.S., two of the three women who went missing in Cleveland 10 years ago have arrived home. Gina DeJesus and Amanda Berry were found alive and rescued on Monday, along with one other woman. Three brothers in Ohio are expected to be charged for their kidnapping later on Wednesday. Police are investigating to see why it took almost 10 years to find the women. We're joined now by NBC's Sarah Daloff, who's in Cleveland. Thanks for joining us. Can you give us a bit of an impression of what is emerging about their time in captivity?
We're learning more about their time in captivity, Lauren, specifically more details about how these women came to be abducted. Gina Jesus today revealing that she was walking home from school in 2004 when a man in a van approached her and offered her a ride. Once inside the home, the women were kept isolated, locked in separate rooms, and no communication, obviously, with the outside world or with each other up until the other day, Monday night.
And it seems that there's a huge media interest in this and a kind of almost, unprecedented scale. How are they coping with this kind of level of attention after all these years in captivity?
Yeah, obviously it is overwhelming to go from seeing very few people to this mass of cameras and well-wishers on the lawn. They're handling it with a lot of grace. The families asking for respect and sensitivity at this time. The FBI has brought in one of their behavioral specialists from Quantico who knows the right level of sensitivity to approach these women after the level of trauma that they have experienced.
And any questions about how it could be that they weren't discovered any sooner?
That is the big question. As you can see, I'm standing on the street where the home is that these three women were kept, and it is a residential area. It is not remote or isolated. There are businesses up and down this street, homes, a daycare, a school, and that is what police very much want to answer. They have launched an internal investigation into the Cleveland Police Department to see if there was anything that was missed or anything that could have been done to bring these women home sooner.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Sarah Donoff, they're reporting from Cleveland. A group of lawyers representing cholera victims in Haiti is threatening to take legal action against the United Nations. Thousands died and hundreds of thousands more were infected. And it's thought UN peacekeepers were to blame. James Bayes reports.
The numbers affected by the epidemic are staggering. More than 8,000 Haitians have died. More than 600,000 people have been infected. That's one in 16 people in the country. Most experts agree on the cause. 10 months after Haiti suffered a devastating earthquake in 2010, the first cases were reported. Al Jazeera filmed these pictures at the time, showing a camp where UN troops from Nepal were based. It's believed by almost everyone who's studied the evidence that it's highly likely sewage contaminated the river water, starting the outbreak. Almost everyone except UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. He's never admitted the UN's responsibility and says the organization is immune from prosecution. Now lawyers representing the victims in Haiti are challenging that. They've given the UN 2 months to change its mind and pay compensation, or they take them to court.
Once day one of trial starts, it's probably the easiest case I've had in 20 years of being a lawyer. The liability is so clear, the damage is so great, it would be an extremely easy case to win once we got to trial, and the damages would be enormous.
The lawyers are considering a number of different countries where they may take out their case against the UN. It's possible they may do simultaneous legal action in more than one jurisdiction. James Bayes, Al Jazeera at the United Nations.
In Spain, the Senate has approved new laws to help cash-strapped Spaniards meet loan payments on their homes and avoid mass evictions. It gives homeowners time to meet their loan repayments. Evictions are particularly controversial in Spain as millions of properties lie vacant following the collapse of the construction industry in 2008. Rory Challens explains.
Calling Valdeluz a ghost town would be misleading. That would imply somewhere that's been deserted. But most of the 30,000 who were supposed to live here never came. Weeds grow in the untended gardens and the playgrounds are silent.
Places like Valdeluz aren't unique. In fact, there are 3.4 million empty homes in Spain at the moment. And when you consider how many people are being evicted from their houses, the number of vacant properties here stops being just an economic problem and it becomes a humanitarian one.
Squatting is one solution. Monica has been unemployed for months. She and her son live in a flat abandoned by friends who fell behind with mortgage payments. Their bags are kept packed for when the police finally come.
There are a lot of empty homes, but the government isn't doing what it needs to. I'm frightened that when I'm evicted, I won't have anywhere else to go, and I'll end up on the street.
Down south, they're trying something more official. Andalusia will fine banks and real estate companies that leave properties empty and in some circumstances even confiscate houses off them. The Canary Islands and Catalonia are trying similar strategies.
This new law intends to put Andalusia's hundreds of thousands of empty houses on the market to make these properties available to rent so that people can exercise their human right to have a home.
But there are economists who think this is just political showboating.
I think it's more of a populist measure, just attention-grabbing. If the regional government wants to fight the problem of evictions, they already have enough tools. 50 or 60,000 social houses could be used, rather than criminalising the banks.
The paradox of homeless families and empty houses is a product of Spain's burst construction bubble. Unfortunately, neither squatting nor punishing the banks is likely to fully solve it. Only jobs and economic growth can do that, and both are some way off. Rory Challens, Al Jazeera, Spain.
Now, after more than two decades of conflict, Somalia's artists are reflecting on the bloodshed of the past. They're using their craft to provoke debate and encourage Somalis to aim for a better future. Peter Gresta has more from Mogadishu.
Aidan Afi Farah is painting what locals call a death flower, a blood-red plant that started growing on Mogadishu's devastated battlefields. His painting is a deliberate attempt to hold a mirror to his own society.
I want the viewers to see what we became through the civil war, to see what we lost and what it turned us into.
His art is part of a much wider project to provoke Somalis. The workshop is producing overtly political paintings designed to make them reflect on the past.
The mother literally lost her mind.
Most Somalis would recognize this as the traditional story of a woman who went mad after she saw her children killed in a fire. She started murdering other children in revenge. The artist intended it as a metaphor for Somalia itself.
I think it's about time that we need to literally sit down and discuss, see a way out of this anarchy that we've been in for the last 22 years. So this piece is literally opens up their mind to see a different view.
But the movement isn't confined to galleries and private walls. The posters appearing at key intersections across Mogadishu are designed to provoke a debate that's been missing for decades.
As much as this art is intended to make Somalis think, its messages don't necessarily reach a much younger, more vulnerable audience. But to reach them, there's a whole new movement using music.
Lila Muhyiddin used to be a child soldier. He knows violence intimately. Now he's a rapper, a young star who talks directly to the nation's youth. They're making a music video ahead of what promoters are calling the Somali Reconciliation Festival. The first music festival here in two decades.
When an Islamic scholar preaches about peace, people often don't listen. But when it comes to music, they rush in and listen. We want to use that to get the message of peace to the people.
The festival was a direct rebuke to the rebel movement Al-Shabaab that dominated Mogadishu for years. The deeply conservative group banned music, dance and mixing of the sexes. But it was also a chance to celebrate the city's new stability and remind Somalis of what a peaceful life can really be like. Peter Grester, Al Jazeera, Mogadishu.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. For the third consecutive day, hundreds of Bolivian miners, factory workers, and teachers were in the streets demanding pension reform. Today, a group of miners blew up a bridge along a major road connecting the eastern and western parts of the country. FSRN's Aldo Orellana reports from Cochabamba.
The Bolivian Workers' Center, the largest organization of unions in the country, called for a nationwide general strike and blockade. The unions want the government to reform pension laws to increase monthly retirement stipends from 70% of a worker's final salary to 100%. Union members block roads linking the west with the east, hoarding freight and passenger traffic. The government called in police to remove the blockades, prompting fierce clashes with factory and mine workers. Several people have been injured. Today, dozens of miners were arrested after they blew up a bridge on a major road linking La Paz to the eastern and south part of Bolivia. Interior Minister Carlos Romero spoke to reporters after the incident.
Police have removed roadblocks to help citizens harmed by the blockade. We've arrested more than 100 people who were carrying and throwing dynamite. Additionally, we have confiscated a minibus containing lots of dynamite.
The government urged the workers to return to negotiations, but anticipated that the desired changes to the pension law are financially untenable. Workers say they will not abandon their demands. Aldo Orellana Lopez, FSRN, Cochabamba.
Today, fighters from the militant Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, began withdrawing from their base in Turkey and are now moving into northern Iraq. The action is part of a peace deal being negotiated directly between the Turkish government and the group to end a conflict that's killed more than 40,000 people since the 1980s. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports from Istanbul.
The spring snowmelt usually heralds what's known here as the fighting season. Last year was especially bloody, with about 500 people killed in summer clashes. But the fighting has slackened since the Turkish government began negotiating with the PKK and its jailed leader Abdullah Öcalan called a ceasefire in March. Pro-Kurdish politicians say about 2,000 militants are now on the move following the withdrawal order. There has been no confirmation from the Turkish government, which has said the military would not interfere. The PKK is demanding the right for Kurds to use their mother language in schools and public institutions. The group also wants political autonomy. But it's unclear how far the Turkish government is willing to go. Gareth Jenkins, an Istanbul-based analyst with Johns Hopkins University's Silk Road Studies program, says all eyes are on the Turkish government to show its hand.
We need to see something concrete from the Turkish government about what it's going to give. It's been saying that this is not a bargaining process and it won't make concessions. In reality, it is a bargaining process and they have to make concessions.
Turkey's Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan is facing a backlash from opposition parties for negotiating directly with the PKK. But a recent poll shows 90% of Turkish citizens approve of the peace process. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
Today, Spain once again prevented victims of human rights abuses under Francisco Franco's regime from testifying in front of a judge. Several Spanish plaintiffs were supposed to make statements to an Argentine court via video conference, but the Spanish Foreign Affairs Ministry asked the Argentine ambassador to suspend the conferences because the Spanish government had not been informed. The Argentine judge consented. From Buenos Aires, Eilish O'Neill has the story.
An estimated 115 people disappeared and 30,000 babies were kidnapped during Francisco Franco's dictatorship in Spain. An amnesty law still prevents Spanish judges from investigating these crimes. To get around these limitations, the son of a man murdered by Franco's troops opened a human rights case in Argentina 2 years ago. Since then, 120 individuals and 62 human rights organizations have joined as plaintiffs. Franco's troops murdered Adriana Fernandez's grandfather.
A lot of people ask you, why open old wounds? But the wounds never healed. They're still open. And while there's still impunity, while the crimes committed under Franco aren't investigated, I don't think that Spain can end the cycle and move forward.
Today's cancellation is the third suspension of testimony. Eilish O'Neill, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
Delaware Governor Jack Markell signed same-sex marriage legislation Tuesday. The bill passed the Senate on a 12-9 vote just minutes before being signed inside the Capitol. The state is now the 11th to approve full marriage equality. Gay and lesbian couples in Delaware will be able to marry beginning July 1st. Former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford has defeated his Democratic challenger Elizabeth Colbert Bush in a special election for the U.S. House of Representatives. Sanford, who was officially censured as governor for ethics violations relating to an extramarital affair, received 54% of the vote in the district, which encompasses the northern coastal counties of the state. The race had received substantial media attention because of Sanford's return to politics and because Colbert Bush is sister of political satirist Stephen Colbert. And that's headlines for FSRN from Eugene, Oregon. I'm Jess Burns.
Hi, I'm Rosie Perez, and this is WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York.
This is Al Jazeera.
Thirty years after his untimely death, Bob Marley lives on as an icon, not just in the world of music, but also in the social realm, at the political grassroots, and in the field of human rights.
The true measure of Bob Marley's greatness can be found in the far-flung corners of the earth, places many of us have barely heard of, but where Bob Marley's music and Bob Marley's message bring joy and inspiration to the lives of millions.
Join the award-winning Midnight Ravers on Friday, May 17th, from 12 midnight to 2 a.m., as we proudly present our marathon special, Bob Marley, Prophet on the Frontline. You know it'll be ravelicious. So tell a friend, tune in, and be sure to show your support. Only on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM.
The Midnight Ravers, where every show is a special.
Attention, conscientious party people with a purpose. The Liquid Sound Lounge is about to kick off its 20th anniversary celebration to benefit WBAI-FM, Saturday, May 11th, from 6 p.m. to 2 a.m., featuring live performances by Groove Collective and DJ sets by Afro, Nappy G, Soul Central Station's Tony Ryan, and of course, Jeannie Hopper. And it's happening at the Shapeshifter Lab, 18 Whitwell Place in the Gowanus section of Brooklyn. Take the R, N, or D trains to Union Street. Tickets are only $20 in advance and $25 at the door. All the proceeds go to benefit WBAI. For more information, go to WBAI.org. See you on the dance floor.
Hi, I'm Ken Gale of WBAI's Tuesday evening environmental show, Ecologic. One of the cool things about being a BAI buddy is that you get to decide what WBAI is worth to you. Are we worth more than your cable TV? Or 10 bucks a month? 20, 100, a million? Just go to the WBAI.org website and sign up with your credit card. You'll barely notice it. In return, you get a WBAI tote bag to show off, free or discounted entry to special WBAI events, and other perks. Another cool thing about being a BAI buddy is less fundraising interruptions to your favorite programs. Go to WBAI.org. You can donate in the name of your favorite show, like Ecologic.
Or Off the Hook, where it's currently about to begin. 7 o'clock, WBAI New York. Time once again for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse.
Listening to Off the Hook here on WBAI in New York. Manuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Alex.
How you doing?
Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Bernie S. somewhere.
Greetings from Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania, okay, great. And Mike's on a field trip somewhere. Mike, are you back? Okay, well, Mike's here. I'll take my word for it. We have a special program tonight. Special program because it's the first night, and Hank Key joined us too. You're not in for another hour. There's a lot of confusion here, and I'm confused as to why people are so confused.
He's looking on our floor.
For what? The floor is where it's supposed to be.
Yeah, well,
I've never seen such perplexed-looking people. What's all this about, Mike? One minute you were here, and then you were gone.
I went to look for a phone number.
Told you the phone number's right here. The pledge line phone number, which we're going to give out, is right in front of me.
All right, well, why don't you tell me what it is, and I'll write it down.
It's 516-620-3602. That's our pledge line, which will become a lot more relevant in a couple of minutes when we actually have something interesting to offer to people. Bernie, you're down there in Philadelphia, you said?
I'm not in Philadelphia, but I am somewhere in the outskirts of Pennsylvania.
Okay. You're aware that we do this every now and then. We have fundraising programs. I know we seem to do it an awful lot, but I just, you know, I want to share some insight on the alternative to alternatives. Basically, what that means is that we ask for support at this radio station because we have no choice, because that's the only way we can stay on the air. We don't have commercials. We don't take underwriting, even. A lot of non-commercial stations that you might listen to, particularly NPR, and that shouldn't come as any surprise, they take underwriting. What that means is they basically say this program is brought to you by Exxon, Mobil, or whatever. While they don't have full-fledged commercials, they have something that's pretty close. Now,
what is the difference?
Well,
there used to be a difference.
There used to be a difference. The difference is you're not supposed to say qualitative things. You're not supposed to say we're better than the competition or anything like that. I can't tell the difference anymore. And if you watch Channel 13, I don't think there is any difference.
So you're just supposed to say, like, ExxonMobil, like, purveyors of gas spills, not ExxonMobil purveyor of the biggest gas spills.
Something like that, yeah.
Okay. Okay. And I bet you, if you actually work for PBS, you can't say either of those.
I think Sydney's coming in now to have a look at the floor. What's wrong with the floor? Why is everyone looking at the floor?
It's a very mysterious studio that we're in.
We're in the basement, so I don't think there's anything below us, unless somebody discovered something below us. In any event, what happens in the commercial radio world, though, you basically are force-fed a steady diet of commercials, full-fledged commercials, not the half commercials or three-quarter commercials that you might see on NPR or PBS, but just constant being shouted at and pitched at. You don't have a choice in this. You have no choice whatsoever. Now, there are other ways. Thank you. There are other ways of all this confusion going on around me. Other methods of listening to quote unquote radio, and one that I became somewhat familiar with in the last couple of months because I had it installed in the car, is something known as Sirius XM. Bernie, I believe you've heard of Sirius XM, have you not?
Yeah, I've heard about it seriously. It was two separate companies, but now
it was Sirius, and the other company was XM. And, it was kind of a misnomer because people thought that, well, there's AM, FM, now there's XM. But, it's not another broadcasting band. It's a company. So it's very different. And now two companies are one company. But, I started listening to this particular hodgepodge of various channels. They basically have, it starts with channel, I guess, one and goes up to a couple of hundred. It sounds kind of cool. You can listen to music, but it's like a music box, like having a bunch of iPods with you. But there are occasional good channels. They really are. One of them was known as World Radio Network. Now, Bernie, you would love World Radio Network. They are an organization that basically plays the equivalent of shortwave. And every half hour, they change to another country and they broadcast a half hour program in English. And it's crystal clear quality, and you can hear it wherever you happen to be in the United States or Canada. It might be Radio Prague at one moment, then it might be Radio France International. It could be Radio Japan or Korea, all sorts of different countries all around the world. It was probably the best channel that they had on this particular service. Now, you might know, because I'm saying it in the past tense, they no longer have it. Right after I renewed, because I had a free trial, I said, okay, you know what? That channel made me really want to get this service. I renewed for an entire year. And then they just took the channel off with no explanation whatsoever. They said, this channel is no longer available. You might enjoy listening to BBC and hearing these programs if you like world news. Going from a couple of dozen sources to one source and saying that people who like world news, well, here, BBC, listen to that. I jumped on their Facebook page and asked them, hey, what gives? I got the exact same reply, word for word, from somebody with supposedly a name, but it was probably just a bot. This is how it works no matter where you go, folks. It works in commercial radio, it works in commercial radio services, and you don't have a say. You don't have a voice. They control things. They take things away. They make you think they're good, and then they just change to a load of crap. Here at BAI, we have a back and forth with the listeners. It's not always pretty, and as you saw after Sandy, things got pretty messy. But we keep bobbing our heads above the water, and we survive, and we hold our values. We don't have commercials. We don't have underwriting. All we have are our listeners.
If I'm not mistaken, Emmanuel, you pay for this this commercial satellite radio service, and some of their channels still have commercials, right?
Oh, yes, very much.
So you pay twice for that, and you pay more than I think we're asking you to give tonight.
Oh, absolutely, yes, most definitely. People pay ridiculous amounts for audio content. It's really something, and it's not audio content that offers anything particularly special. It's not anything you couldn't play yourself. What we have here at WBAI, it is very unique. Every hour you have a different program virtually around the clock, and you hear all kinds of differing perspectives, things you disagree with, things you do agree with. And also, you have a phone number to call to speak on the air many, many times. Tonight, though, you have a phone number to call to help us out and keep this radio station going. Now, what we have, we've put together a very interesting package of history for you, because it's all about history. Everywhere you go, it's always about history. And this particular radio show on this particular radio station has quite a sordid history to it. We started back in 1988, and what has happened in the weeks that have passed by since then is that the world has changed. Technology has changed. Telephones, computers, all sorts of devices exist that didn't exist before. Our society has changed. The world has changed. We live in a post-9/11 world now, whatever that is. We've talked about all kinds of developments that have happened. And it's basically a time capsule. What we are offering to you tonight is the full spectrum, everything from the beginning to the end of 2012. And what that means is every single radio show that we have ever done on this radio station, which comes out to, I think, well over 1,000 hours of audio on 23 DVDs. Yeah, that is what we are offering tonight. It's a most incredible deal for 100.